Well, good day, and welcome to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and we are full house tonight, folks. We've got five amazing people on the call. Well, four amazing people and me, but that's okay. And, of course, the first amazing person I get to introduce is Sam Bradley, my co-host. Hey, Sam.
Ah, you're amazing too, Jamie. Come on now. Yes, we do have a good group. It's going to be a lot of fun. We got some updates from New Orleans, and we got a very special friend of Joe Holly's on, along with Joe, and we're going to talk about the big ditch in Arizona. And that's one of my most exciting places in the world to go, so I'm looking forward to that. So we'll start with Kyle. Kyle, what's we had a recent weather report, but I don't know if anything's happening since the other day, but you've also got, I'd like to hear more about your classes you got going on in Denver that I really wish I could have been at. Talk about that a bit.
Yeah, definitely, Sam. And first off, in the weather world, there's actually been quite a bit happening with regards to both winter weather and summer-like severe weather, especially in the east of the Mississippi, in the Midwest, and across the east central parts of the United States. February 28th, we had a pretty widespread severe weather event, spawning tornadoes from Arkansas through Missouri up through Illinois, both southern and lower parts of Illinois. And those so far, at least 25 that have been reported, and several more that are still being discovered and confirmed. I've seen reports up to EF3 strength tornadoes occurring in northern Illinois as well as northern Indiana. So those EF3s, more northern Illinois, smaller ones in northern Indiana, but still very unusual weather for late February in the Midwest. And of course, as those storms decayed and progressed into the nighttime hours, they moved to the east. And as they decayed, all that precipitation that was suspended up in those hail cores up high rushed out and caused significant wind damage across Kentucky, West Virginia, Virginia, and all the way out to the East Coast on March 1st. So big time weather there for summer severe weather. And of course, winter weather continuing in the Rockies as well, with up to a foot of snow and or more in some places. And that's a little bit about what's happening with weather across the U.S. But I'm actually down in Denver this week teaching a couple of courses for the National Disaster Preparedness Training Center. Today I taught the Tornado Awareness course, and tomorrow I'll be delivering the Winter Weather Hazards course. And, of course, these are no-cost trainings that are offered to anyone who's interested to take them. Any agency can host these trainings, and we are being graciously hosted by the Denver Anschutz Medical Campus, which contains Children's Hospital and many other great medical facilities on the in Aurora, Colorado. So that's where we're hanging out, delivering and sharing lots of great weather knowledge to keep people more informed and so that they can be more educated consumers of weather information.
Yeah, I know. And I'll tell you, Kyle, we got some of that wind here in Maryland, you know, as it came across. It was quite a windy day today. And I know that Joe and some of those tornadoes and some of those storms were going through Tennessee as well.
Yeah, those storms did move and from west to east there. Once they finished dropping tornadoes and things, they moved eastward. And, yeah, several severe weather reports, especially high wind reports from across Tennessee and all throughout that part of Appalachia.
Well, the way we're going, this seems to be the year of the tornado, almost literally from day one of this year. We've had them in places where we don't usually see them either, so it's going to be interesting to see how the rest of the year looks. Strange weather already.
Yes.
And it, ironically, as a good segue, we had that little outbreak in New Orleans not too long ago. But New Orleans has other things going on right now, and that's one of the reasons I wanted to bring BJ in. Some of you, if you watch the news, would have heard about 12 people being injured in the parade down there. So BJ has been sending us pictures. You're going to have to tell us about that parade, what it's all about, and what you know about what happened down there.
Sure, definitely. Good afternoon, everybody. First of all, that's Endymion was the parade. Endymion is probably the largest, most extravagant crew during the Mardi Gras season. It's the Saturday night before Fat Tuesday. It's it draws the largest crowds and has kind of the most expensive floats and all that. So it really is the biggest thing that's happening in the city for that whole Mardi Gras event. And what happened is near the start of the parade, we had someone who had been, let me back up a second and say the parades had been going on all day. The first parade on Saturday kicked off at 11 a.m. Most people had been out on the parade routes on the streets all day long. This was close to the 7 at night when this happened. And somebody who had a blood alcohol level of 0.223, I believe, is what his blood alcohol was, got in his vehicle, tried to drive away, and drove into the crowd. And he injured 31 people. 24 of those people were hospitalized. He's charged with you had said 12 earlier. He's charged with 12 counts of vehicular negligent injury and 10 counts of first degree vehicular negligent injury as well. So he's not getting out anytime soon, but it was one major disaster event, the parade itself. I mean, you're talking a million plus people on a parade route, and then having this suddenly happen all at one time. It was a strain on all the resources that was going on, but they did a stellar job in triaging and setting up a situation where they could get everybody taken care of, treated, and moved out to the point where they only delayed the parade about an hour, and then the parade continued to roll after that.
Wow. BJ, I'm kind of surprised that cars would even have access to where there's a parade route with that many pedestrians. I'm trying to envision how that looked.
Well, it's kind of strange that where the parade started is a very suburbanish kind of area of New Orleans itself, more residents and all that. So they don't barricade off the route, and the people just line the street. Like down in the area where I was, which is close to where we were for the convention last year, they literally barricade both sides of the street so people can't step out into the general course where everything is. Where this happened, he got in the car and literally drove right into 7 to 10 people deep for the parade. You know, people with their backs turned, looking up at the floats, and he drove right into the crowd.
Oh, what do you know about the injuries? I assume there were no fatals, but I'm sure there were some serious injuries.
No fatalities. From what I heard from the people I talked to, we have a couple of severe, one potentially critical. I believe that is related with chest trauma due to the impact. Most were falls and scrapes, that sort of issues, with a few broken bones mixed in. Kind of the whole gambit of walking wounded all the way to major trauma triage needed in that list of injuries.
Wow. Well, we hope the rest of the Mardi Gras festivities are a little more mellow. I know it's a crazy time down there.
Everything wrapped up yesterday. Surprisingly, we had a really good Mardi Gras holiday otherwise, no other major events, but it's kind of it's horrible for somebody like me to look and see that we had a very similar event like this 20 years ago on St. Patrick's Day, where somebody who had been drinking, who was actually in the parade with a vehicle, drove into the crowd and caused 20 plus injuries. And you hate to see these kind of things repeat. You would hope people would learn from these things, but it's just a horrible event. I know the age range for this event over the weekend, the youngest person injured was 1 year old, and they had somebody who was 56 who was injured. So kind of across the board.
Wow. Well, I'm going to have Dr. Joe introduce his guest, and he sounds like a fascinating guy, talking about my favorite hole in the ground in Arizona. So I'm sure that BJ, you and Kyle might have some questions, because this is something very different than we talked about before. So, Joe, I'm going to let you run with this and introduce Drew and see what he has to say. I'm looking forward to it.
Well, hi, Sam, and welcome, everybody. Thanks for joining us on the podcast tonight. It's my real privilege to introduce an old friend, an amazing EMS physician who is based in Albuquerque, and who, in addition to all the work that he does for Albuquerque, has medical direction jurisdiction over Yellowstone. So, Drew, welcome to the podcast. We're really glad to have you, man. Thanks for joining us tonight.
Appreciate it, Joe. And I just want to throw it out there. It's the Grand Canyon, not Yellowstone. But
exactly right. Grand Canyon. So sorry.
That's all right. But Luann Freer would come looking for me if I took her job in Yellowstone.
No doubt. Sorry about that.
Smaller hole, Joe.
All right. Yes.
So, Drew, tell us about yourself and what you do, and then we'll talk about the Grand Canyon. Sounds fascinating.
Sure, yeah. I appreciate everybody for thinking enough of me to have me on. I have been here in Albuquerque about 10 years and have been the medical director for the Grand Canyon. We were just out there last week, as a matter of fact, after Joe and I and his lovely wife, Kimberly, were in Dallas for another wonderful conference. We were out there teaching our ALS refresher with our group in the Grand Canyon, and we've been there almost 4 years now. And it is a wonderful place to visit, as many of you know, and it's an even greater place, but at times very challenging place to practice out-of-hospital medicine with what would be the entire spectrum of out-of-hospital care. There are several areas in the park that function just like any large, you know, urban, maybe suburban, probably a better description given a little bit of the remoteness, but a large suburban community with all of the infrastructure that goes along with it. And then there are some of the most remote, and Joe, I think it's appreciable to say, comparative to Yellowstone, areas in the United States where it is very difficult to get resources and to rescue and to provide out-of-hospital care in a very austere environment. And, you know, you pick it, we can probably come up with it. You fall off a boat and get hurt, check. You fall off a very large cliff that you should have been watching better. Yep. Fall off of a mule, as the case may be, bit by you name whatever rabid animal might be running around down in there in the canyon. And it's a wonderful group of people that I get to work with, and some spectacular scenery for sure.
Well, the entire thing sounds horrible.
I know it's one of those. Please don't throw me back in that briar patch. I mean, there are worse places to have to be an EMS medical director and to be involved in out of hospital care. In my scope of a career and arc, starting as a wilderness EMT many, many years ago, there are a few places that rival the scenery and at times the remoteness and the challenges that go along with providing care in the Grand Canyon.
Well, and that's sort of exactly, what I was thinking. That matches up very well with disaster situations that we talk about on this podcast a lot. And, you know, for you, that's almost a day-to-day occurrence where you get an opportunity to really practice disaster medicine on a very regular basis, because the issues in dealing with that park and the austere environment that is there it sort of covers the gamut from, swift water rescue to vertical walls and difficult access and temperature extremes and lack of technological support and the whole gamut of stuff that comes along with trying to work in a very austere environment.
Yeah. And Joe, that is a wonderful kind of synopsis, because we could have wrapped up into one call all of those events where the crew has been able to call us only because they have satellite coverage, because they're down in the canyon dealing with somebody that fell out of a boat, had a swift water rescue, and is in a really remote part of the canyon, and it's getting dark, and due to very appropriate, very conservative, safety-oriented mindset within the Park Service and particularly within the Emergency Services Branch, really doing an outstanding job. I can't speak enough of the men and women that provide care there to do appropriate risk assessments for what the risk and benefit to a rescue in a helicopter at night flying in, as y'all probably can appreciate, really dark, rocky terrain without a lot of identifiable landmarks. And we might have, because of satellite rotation and weather and any number of things, decisions that you just don't come across in your standard run-of-the-mill, even in some of the disaster scenarios. As a former USAR physician, the things that I've had to deal with and think through complexity-wise in the Grand Canyon really have eclipsed several of the USAR scenarios that we were faced with, because we bring, when we come from a USAR standpoint or a DMAT disaster medicine approach, we bring a lot of equipment and people, and you might get a call from a provider in a helicopter that says, hey, I'm river mile 69, river left, with somebody that's fallen and is combative, and I'm worried about being able to get them out, and it's about to get dark. We need to walk through a big sedation protocol, or we're going to be with them overnight because we can't fly, because the weather has socked us in, and we're going to be taking care of somebody in a prolonged environment where they're using a lot of point-of-care testing. We use a lot of ISTAT cartridges in the Grand Canyon, looking at hyponatremia, have a huge exertional hyponatremia issue, and then being able to make some decisions that most frontline EMS providers in the United States are never faced with, because the 20, 30, even if you put them in really remote scenarios, you know, half hour, 45 minutes, maybe a couple hours of transport time could end up being overnight because you just can't get out. It's hard when the weather socked you in to get somebody out of the canyon. And there are some real challenges to that. And I can't say enough about the folks that provide care out there and how well they've been able to improvise, as the case may be, on a regular basis to provide outstanding care.
So, Drew, this is Joe again. That's phenomenal complexity levels. Could you talk a little bit about how those guys and yourself included sort of prep for that kind of scenario? I mean, you touched on it already. You guys do point of care testing, and I would just be fascinated to hear a little bit about how you pack out a bag for the idea that we may be down there for 24 hours in, you know, both cold at night and heat during the day and all the other issues that you may face. How do you move all that stuff? How do you decide which of those items are priority?
Well, Joe, I've got to tell you, and guys, as a group, and I've been out there now, you know, I go several years, we go out several times a year. We do a lot of refresher training with them. And I try and go out and spend some time with the providers in the canyon, because that's really where you can see the fruits of labor in terms of the work involved with building and continuing to work upon the magnificent efforts that I really have to give a shout out to Ken Phillips and Brandon Torres, the former and current branch chiefs for emergency services there, in the amount of energy and effort and amazing people that they put on the ground that want to do really good care in really, really difficult places. And I think you have to start, Joe, with that question that you asked about, what do you decide to put in your pack? And it's not the urban EMS, you know, jump bag that we're used to, because as is often the case, if we're not flying it in 368, our rotor ship there on the South Rim that's dedicated to the park, we're carrying it. And you might be carrying it by yourself, as is the case maybe, or about with you know, maybe one other person. And so it really hones down your focus on what you need. And we are very good. I shouldn't say we. I mean, it's like I'm there all the time. But the providers there are outstanding at making use of and really being able to appropriately troubleshoot what's needed and work through a very elegantly simple, straightforward way to figure out. Because if I'm carrying it plus all the other gear that I need, it really truncates the amount of weight. And so we've worked really hard. We have a lot of, I think, as everybody would expect, our shoulder seasons, or I should say our focus, is during the warmer months of the year. Though, as the centennial for the Park Service has come through, we've had, I think we're on track for more than 5 million visitors there to the Grand Canyon this year. We've had a much higher consistent volume over previous years, but once it starts to get warm, that's when things really get busy, particularly on the rims. It's 6,000, 6,500, 7,000 feet on the south rim, upwards of 7,500 or 8,000 feet on the north rim. And the north rim closes during the winter because of snow and access. But once things open up and people really get hopping, the rim-to-rim folks, once the north rim is open, really drives a lot of exertional hyponatremia and just kind of heat-related illnesses that you would expect in any given scenario. But as we like to describe, and as the Grand Canyon really is set up to most appropriately show, it's the perfect people trap, because nowhere else do you start the highest you're going to be for the entire day and hike down all day long. And then when you turn around, after having maybe gone farther than you should, realize, well, dang, I got to go all the way back up to the canyon rim. And so it's set up to get people in trouble if they're not prepared.
Yeah, I'll have to throw in here, been there, done that. My cousin, who's a doctor here in Denver, many years ago now, but we made that hike. But she's very forward-thinking in terms of preparedness. What are we going to carry? We're going to go down. We're going to spend the night there. And then we're going to come back up the next morning. But it is a rough hike. And I remember how hot it was coming back up out of there. That was probably the worst thing I remember about it, was just having to deal with that heat and dehydration and hypernatremia, all of that, like you were talking about. So I expect that there's a whole lot of what you guys deal with is people being unprepared, or just those that think they can put on a pair of shorts and a T-shirt and go hike the day and get caught at night when it gets colder and not be prepared for it. I expect you see a lot of that.
We do, and I actually, you'd be surprised. So you would think that it would, and we have very large temperature swings, particularly because of elevation and the dryness and the big swings in temperature once we lose a lot of the solar input from the sun. But usually people get in trouble oftentimes before it gets dark, because I think you touched on it best, because you can go down really easy, and the preventive search and rescue program that was implemented several years ago due to increasing call volume for people getting in over their head really looked to make sure that folks were prepared and aware of the risks, because as we like to say, down is elective, up is mandatory, because when you turn around, you got to come home and you're staying on the South Rim. There ain't nobody coming down there to just fetch you as people go, well, can I get a mule or a helicopter? I'm like, no, not really so much. And you have to do, I think, a lot of the work that the PSAR program has done in the Park Service there in Grand Canyon to educate people to the risks associated with saying, well, can I just hike down to the Grand Canyon? Hike down into the Grand Canyon and go to the Colorado and back in a day? Sure, but starting at 11 in the morning with your T-shirt and shorts and your shopping bag full of water with a couple of quarts is probably a bad way to set up yourself up for success.
I completely agree. Joe, you had another thought that you wanted to throw out there.
This is Joe again. So I think in lieu with what you were just talking about, you told me a fascinating story of a guy that decided he was going to, you know, do both sides of the canyon and back in a day. And the issues that you guys faced with, sort of what you had to do with that guy. Can you tell us that story?
Sure. And Joe, I think it's worth saying that there are a lot of individuals that do the rim to rim, or the rimmed, or R3, as we call it, so rim to rim to rim. And there are plenty of individuals that are well-prepared and know the rigorous preparation that have to go into getting yourself set up to do this. And even at the best of circumstances, with the best of preparedness and a really high level of fitness, there are still individuals that, having done several, you know, of the large kind of top shelf Western States ultra marathons, whether that be Western States or the Wasatch 100 or any number of the very large, long, very arduous ultra marathons, can still get into shape, because Grand Canyon has heat, lots of elevation loss and gain, and temperature swings that are unique to the environment. And this individual, a well-prepared, seasoned ultra marathoner, doing rim to rim to rim. I believe it was two seasons ago. Found himself, probably got behind a little bit, got a little dehydrated. And the kind of the deadly vortex for us is you get a little behind, a little dehydrated, start to get nauseated, start throwing up, can't keep up with your fluid intake. And on his way back from Phantom Ranch down at the bottom on the Colorado back towards the South Rim, proceeded to get farther and farther behind in his hydration status and his fluid intake, as well as electrolyte replacement and other things. And I was out there working with the PSAR group, and we had gotten a request, and they have a, and I should, I can't speak enough to how much of a difference the PSAR program and the very dedicated volunteers that work diligently, and these are almost exclusively volunteers for the Park Service that come out there and do volunteer preventive search and rescue patrols to ward off against this. We know that at about a level of about 95 degrees from an ambient temperature, that we have a pretty good expectation looking at historical records that we're going to have a much higher call volume if we are not proactive in making sure that people stay hydrated and is oftentimes might get the admonition from the PSAR folks is like, that's probably not a good idea to try and go to the Colorado River and back today, starting at 10:30 in the morning. You're not prepared. And that's, you know, it's still, I think, refreshing that folks will take that appropriate direction and maybe influence to help them have a better experience in the park and to help the individuals that are there to provide care, keep people out of trouble. But this guy, you know, back to our story, very fit, very healthy ultramarathoner, got behind, started getting dehydrated, started getting nauseated, started throwing up. And by the time I was sent down by the then PSAR coordinator, CJ Malcolm, to try and make some contact, we had gotten enough information that we thought this individual was really sick. And he goes, you know what? Maybe we should both go, which was a cue that this is going to be. And CJ and I got to the guy's side and realized, wow, he's really sick. And we have a very robust approach to the exertional hyponatremia in the Grand Canyon, unique, I would say, for sure in the United States that I know of. And Joe, anybody else, y'all please chime in, but maybe even in the world, where we have providers doing 3% saline, hypertonic saline rehydration with appropriate point of care testing, because we are almost assured that all of these individuals started with the normal sodium in the morning and got behind either because of hydration or overhydration, as the case may be, and have a very, very large case series of exertional hyponatremic patients, some of which have sodiums that are in the one teens that any of us in the medical field realize is a dramatic change in a very short amount of time. And we are actually rehydrating a lot of these people with hypertonic to get them well enough to at least guard against needing a flight out of the canyon, where they are able to kind of recuperate maybe where they're living, whether it's at Phantom Ranch or even at Indian Gardens in the canyon. And this guy, we were able to give a couple of 100 cc boluses of 3%, and he was determined to get out of the canyon. And I appreciate his moxie. And we told him, we left his IV in on the side of the trail. We had given him a couple boluses, and we told him pretty much straight up, we're like, if you can hike up 200 yards, we'll see about going up, because up was clearly mandatory, but we weren't sure that we could get him to the next helipad, which was closer down. And to his credit, he took about 50 yards worth of steps, and he goes, yeah, you're right. I'm not going to get the next 3 miles out of the canyon. So we had to put one of our ships down at the 3 mile house evac point, which is where we have one of the helipads. And I say pad very loosely, because in the Grand Canyon, which is one of the reasons why we have very tight flight restrictions on who can land, pad could be something big enough to just stick the skids on and leave your tail rotor hanging out over, shall we say, the abyss, before you can fly out. So it's a great place to practice medicine and work with some amazing folks. And, you know, that's one of dozens of stories that go towards I think the dedication and the unique challenges that the folks in the Grand Canyon face on a daily basis, really.
Drew, I'm kind of wondering, one of my favorite hikes down there is going through the West End through the Havasupai Reservation, and you have to get a permit. And you actually have to plan months ahead to get this permit because they only allow so many people. And then at some point, you get through and you get into the national park area. How is the interaction between the reservation and the PSAR?
So, you know, from the Park Service standpoint, Havasupai being much farther west, and the tribal lands, you know, being respectful of sovereign nations. And I think that's oftentimes lost on folks here in Albuquerque and in the greater New Mexico and throughout the Southwest. There are very, very robust and mature civilizations that predate, the European settlers by centuries is often the case. And that provides unique opportunities for interaction, and the Havasupai control very, very strongly the access down to the Havasupai Canyon. And we get some requests. Anybody that is in need of medical assistance within the greater Colorado River Basin will certainly have the opportunity, if need be, for Grand Canyon EMS, and they will oftentimes, if are needed, can move anywhere up or down the canyon. There's about more than 250 river miles within the Grand Canyon National Park borders, which is oftentimes lost on folks. And if you laid this thing out and spread out all of the contours for the greater Colorado catchment area there where the Grand Canyon is, it's a really large piece of real estate in the Southwest there. And our interactions with tribal lands and sovereign nations either east or west of us is in a collaborative approach. And if need be, and the request came out for an individual that was needing rescue, I know that on a regular basis, the Grand Canyon ship will move up or down the Colorado River area as needed. For folks that are needing medical care and extraction on a case-by-case basis.
Good to know. Fortunately, I never needed their services.
And that's going to wrap up this episode of the Disaster Podcast. We actually went a little long, so we decided to split this into two episodes so you guys could get a little bit more of Dr. Harrell and his amazing experiences in the Grand Canyon as the medical director of response there. And so we'll be bringing that back to you. We do want to thank our sponsors, Paragon Medical Education Group, for their continued support of the Disaster Podcast. Remember to check out all of their resources and training and things that they can bring into your facility, your jurisdiction, your system, whatever the case may be. They can bring in some amazing experiential disaster-related training for you and your other responders. So please check them out over at Paragon Medical Education Group. That's paragonmedicalgroup.com, or you can find them on Twitter at ParagonMedEDU. And of course, there's links to them also over at the Disaster Podcast site at disasterpodcast.com. We'll be back soon with more and part two of this episode coming up next week. In the meantime, remember that disaster medicine is not your everyday medicine.